Let's take our Bibles once again and look in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And I want to read from verse 47 down to verse 52 and talk about a life of abandonment. By that I mean when the Scriptures say that God gives men up to their own reprobate minds. Sometimes we may think that that means they become mean and they live lives of outward hardness and just difficult to get along with. And yet, the deception of that is the fact that I think of even Cain, who clearly the Lord gave over to his own reprobate mind, and yet for a lifetime blessed him materially with success. But in doing so, that's what he wanted. That's what we forget. We think that God's just holding men at bay and they really would like to be his, but God's the one holding them off. No, it's just the opposite. The resistance of the heart, the rebellion of the heart is there from birth. And it's just a matter of God letting men go. And the hardening is many times in their success. And that's what we see here of Saul. There's no question this was a man that God had given over to his own reprobate mind. A life of abandonment. And yet, verse 47, we read, so Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side. Isn't that why Israel asked for a king? It had nothing to do with God being their king. It was, we need a king that can show his power against all the enemies around us. That was their concern. That's all we ask. Give us a king. It's like many a day. Just give me a good life. That's what they ask of God. Give me, could be riches, or some might say, I just want to be able to live a good life and have the bills paid and have a big family and all these things that people look at and think, wow, the Lord's blessed you. Well, that's what Saul had. All his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the children of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. And whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them. People look at that and think, wow, God's presence is with him. Surely God must be with him. I fear that many today have that view of national Israel because they look on the map. And I don't know the last time you looked, but that's a pretty small area of land. And then you look at the size of some of the countries around them that are enemies that would have vowed for the absolute destruction of the land of Israel and any that are natural citizens of it. And here we go. There they are. And people look at it and think, well, see, they are the people of God. It must be because look how God is keeping them. But I will tell you, they're as much God haters as the very enemies that they're fighting. Saul was as much a God hater as these very enemies that he was fighting. No difference. It's just that God purposed for his reason to protect that land, and we know why. You can read in the Old Testament, when Israel got proud of their heritage, already in the book of Deuteronomy, the Lord reminded them that it wasn't for anything good in them that he had chosen them and set them apart. It wasn't in them. It was God's overall purpose to preserve that land and bring his son from that seed. All the way through here, this is what God is doing in his providence, preserving a seed from which His Son should come. And as Paul wrote in Romans, God bless forever that seed. That was Christ. That's what Paul wrote there in Galatians chapter 3. That, and not to seeds, as if it was plural, but to thy seed, and he says, which is Christ. That's what this is all about. It's not about Saul. It's not about these enemies. It's not about them doing something to gain God's favor. It's just God doing His work. And that's the amazing thing about the mystery of providence, God's providence, is that He's God. And kings are His servants. The most vicious dictators that have ever lived are accomplishing God's will and purpose. The religious world doesn't think so. They think, well, we need to get rid of that king. Well, you know when that king will be dethroned is when God purposes it, and not before. Not after. But just because God raises them up and uses them for His purpose and glory, it doesn't mean that they're the Lord's. Paul wrote that in Romans 9 about Pharaoh. He raised him up, Pharaoh, that he might reveal his power in him to destroy him. And you say, well, how could he do that? Well, he's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We don't have any question to where when a father says to the son, do this, do that, there's an expectation that there's going to be respect. When an employer says to an employee, do this or do that, there's an expectation there's going to be a following of that order or get fired. And the same with kings on earth. It's just expected that when the king decrees and declares that that's the will that the people are to follow. That's why the Lord warned Israel. He said, you want a king? I'll give you a king. But he's going to come and take a tenth of everything you raise, and he's going to tax you, and he's going to serve his own interests in doing it. And they said, that's the kind of king we want. So men can't really complain, but they do. When God determines to do what He will. There's where the true rebellion of men is manifest. Because men want their choice. They want to be able to dictate. They want to be able to say what will be and what isn't. But when God directs and determines, you can see the anger. When you start talking about God ruling over ruling, they start talking about their idol, their will. Yeah, but man's got a free will. So here's an example of Saul. He was doing everything he wanted to do and enjoying the glory of it. And if you don't believe it, as we get on in this story, when the Lord began to raise up David and David started having more victories than Saul, that's where this jealousy came out. See, when you think, here's this guy supposedly humble, hiding behind the straw when it came time to inaugurate and anoint him king and all this false humility, but as he got a taste for power, all the while he himself receiving what he desired. So again, it wasn't God holding him down, suppressing him, and he really would not rather be doing this, but now God's making him. No. A life of abandonment. God giving men over to their desires. And yet it's for their destruction. That's why we read in Ecclesiastes 5, be careful what you ask. What is the most vital? What is important? It says there in verse 48, he gathered a host. Again, you see a king directing here, gathered a host. He just, his wish is his command. And there was a following. These were, to gather them means they went willingly with him and smote the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled them. So here's that outward success from the standpoint of his power and position as a king. Most people reading just that would think, wow, God blessed him. It's like people today, they believe they're blessed because of the material things that they have. And then down here in verse 49, you get down to his family. It says, now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishwi and Malchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these, the name of the firstborn Merib, and the name of the younger Michael. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his host was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. You sit there and wonder, well, why did the Spirit direct Samuel to write this about Saul's family? Well, he was a king. This is royalty. People today like to get on Ancestor.com and trace their roots back to some kind of royalty. Well, what difference does it make generations removed, whether or not you have royal blood in you or not? A lot of people like to make a big deal of that, as if you're going to pay them a little more respect because they found out they had some DNA that goes back to King George. That doesn't matter in life. The point is that outwardly he had a family. Of course, they didn't have cameras back then to take a royal family picture, but I can envision today, here's the whole royal family. And yet I ask you, so from that standpoint, though a reprobate, this is an amazing thing in God's providence. There's times where he'll give reprobates a large family, and isn't that what most people you talk to are so thankful for? I'm so thankful for my family, so thankful. Everybody's all together. We've always done this as a family. And then you stop and think about your own family. And like David said, with his house, it wasn't so. There was trouble, division, there's split. Now, that causes sometimes some reflection, because you, like David in Psalm 73, he envied the wicked until the Lord showed him their end. And that's where he thanked the Lord. He said, though it be not so with my house, yet God hath established for me an everlasting covenant. Do we enjoy our family? Yes. But having your family all around you, all neatly in order, is not necessarily a sign of God's blessing. In fact, Christ said that. He didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. And he's going to test us. He's going to separate us out unto himself, whether anybody else follows or not. But one thing I see here, and I haven't been able to study this to the depth that I would like, if I had had time, and maybe you can do this and come back and tell me what you find, but when I see names like this in Scripture, I always try to look further on and see, well, maybe one of these was the Lord's. Even though Saul was a reprobate, maybe one of these was the Lord's. And all of a sudden, you look down through here. What's the very first name mentioned? Verse 49. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan. I don't know anything about Ishwi or Malchishua. It almost sounds Japanese, doesn't it? But it's Do some research. These names have no significance, even though they were all sons of Saul. But then you stop and think, why Jonathan? Well, that's God's the mystery of providence, that it could be in the most evil family ever. And yet one of those is the Lord's, that he's been pleased to pull like a firebrand out of the fire. And it didn't stop with Jonathan, did it? When we read on, when David finally, the Lord put him on that throne, and he was lopping heads off of Saul's household. That was what they did back there, kill all the enemies. There was one. He went and fetched Mephibosheth, lame from a fall. But what? Jonathan's son. Went and fetched him in Lodabar and brought him, set him at his table. And I love to think about how he would have sat at David's table with all the rest of the sons. Still lame, had to be carried, but no one could see his feet. You know, from here up, he just looked like anybody else. He was at the king's table. We're all lame from the fall. And yet, when it pleases God to reveal Christ in us, it's by his grace and mercy. And God's going to prove that. You can have a family that was raised under the gospel, and the Lord passed by every one of those descendants. And you can have one over here. I hear people say all the time, I'm thank God I wasn't raised a Muslim. Well, you know what? There may be some among Muslim families that the Lord has been pleased to choose out from eternity for whom Christ paid the debt. And guess what? He's going to call them. It's not the fact that they grew up over there in some desert land that condemns them. God will move men and nations through war and famine to get his elect wherever they began, to where they'll hear of Christ and the Spirit will draw them. Naaman the Syrian, that offended many of the Jews, but the Lord used that as an example of his grace. Syria? That's our enemy. But he said there were many lepers in Israel, and to none of them did he send a prophet save to Naaman the Syrian. Many widows in Israel, but to none of them did he send a prophet save the widow of Sarepta. And as I mean, to us it may not mean a whole lot, but think of areas where you might think that, can anything good come out of there? And yet when he said Sarepta, that was outside of Israel, both cases. These are people that did not grow up under the hearing of the gospel. And yet in time, the Lord sent the gospel to them. That's his sovereignty to do. I do know we're going to study about Jonathan. God had his hand on him. And then you get down and keep reading. He mentions two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn, Merib, and the name of the younger, Michael. I don't know if that name means anything, but as we get on here into chapter 18, she was the daughter that Saul gave to David to become his wife. You say, how's that the younger, verse 49, was given to David and not the older? Well, the Lord turns the table sometimes. And he'll accomplish his will so that in the end, he gets the glory. That's why Jacob and Esau, the older shall serve the younger. There wasn't any difference between them as far as what womb they were born in and how they came forth. In time, it should have been Esau that was the heir, but Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Such is God's will and providence. But the point is that with all of this that Saul had, outwardly you look at the blessing of His kingdom, His power, of men that pledged allegiance to Him and followed Him, His family, all of these. But in reality, He did not have any control of any of it. It was God directing all the while. He raises up and He puts down. Such is the God of Scripture. But here's the part in conclusion down in verse 52. It says, there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto him. You say, what's the point there? The point is that Saul never had rest. And we read about that in Ecclesiastes, how no matter what the Lord has given to men, their labor, their life is one of labor. It doesn't necessarily mean happiness. Power and position and prominence, these are not necessarily things that bring happiness. And especially if the Lord has given you over to your own reprobate mind, think back, and I know as the Lord teaches us and we rejoice in the light of His Word, and by His Word I mean His Son, the further we removed we are from that life before the Lord was pleased to reveal Christ in us, we can easily forget what it was like to be in darkness and not know it. And so that's why I believe it's important for us to see here the outward appearance of position and power, not necessarily a sign of success. I remember sitting down one time and it was on A&E, that series, biography, and I thought, it'd be interesting, educational, sit down, and they take different people that were well known and they do a movie, a documentary about their life. And people that well known, they had Marilyn Monroe, they had Elvis Presley, they had Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, Eric Clapton, some of these you may or not know. And I thought, well, it would be interesting to see a little bit about their lives because these were famous people. But I got depressed in watching it because as you dig deep into people's lives, regardless of what the outward is, you get to see that that is not a lifestyle that I would want. And I thank the Lord that I don't have that desire to be that way. But there are many like that that live in infamy. They're well known. Their names remain for some time until someone else more important comes along, and then pretty soon they're like back there. It's like today, go out on the street and ask people, what do you think of Eisenhower? Who? You know, what do you think of George Patton? Who? You know, that's not their deal. They don't care. Douglas MacArthur, who, what do you... But many of the freedoms we enjoy today were these men that the Lord raised up to provide for us the comfort and freedoms that we enjoy and take for granted. And yet, I go back and I read the lives of Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur and find out they were just as crass and brutal in their minds and hearts is the very enemy they were killing. And the amazing thing is that in this lifetime, the Lord puts them in a position to kill off these enemies just like Saul. And yet, on the other side of eternity, they all share the same end. Except it be one that God was pleased to deliver, like Saul of Tarsus. He was brutal, vicious, hated the church, hated the name of Christ, killed many that professed to be the Lord's, no one even praying for him. And yet there's an example of a firebrand taken out of the fire. When it pleased God, he said, to reveal Christ in me. That made the difference. And so, when I read here in verse 52, there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. All the days of Saul. The Lord prospered him, but didn't give him any rest. You know, be careful what you ask for, because when we read the scriptures about such a man, we know that that life of abandonment meant, first of all, that he lived a life alienated from the life of God. And through the ignorance and blindness of the heart. If you read in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 18. So how great is our blessing? Think of Lazarus and the rich man. Who had the true riches? It was Lazarus. Even though he spent his lifetime, the dogs came and licked his sores. Men walking by looked at him and said, he's a condemned man. The rich man, people looked at him and said, he's blessed of God. But it was just the opposite. What is it to be given over to our own reprobate minds? In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 18, it says here, having the understanding darkened. What that means is, whatever understanding they have, they don't perceive aright. When God gives men temporal blessings, they're happy. That's all they want. And Cain said, my judgment is too much to bear. God gave him over to his own reprobate mind in giving him a life that was compared to Abel's. Abel was killed. But Cain continued on. So you look at that and you think, wow, well, you know, God prospered Cain only temporally. And Cain was happy with that. That's all he wanted. That's the darkened understanding. There's no sense of urgency of the soul. Saul didn't have it. All of these things that the Lord gave him were like distractions to him. Like kept him going, but never satisfied. I always have to get one more. I think it was Alexander the Great. After he conquered the whole world, he sat down and cried on a rock because there wasn't anybody else to conquer. People live that way. Being alienated from the life of God. The life of God is Christ. Alienated means to be a stranger. It's to be one that, even though men might profess him, he says, I never knew you. Through the ignorance that is in them. What ignorance? Trying to approach God another way than what God has ordained. It's like Saul, because of the blindness of their heart. And it says, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. See, that's the perfect example of God's sovereignty. He gives men over to their own reprobate minds, but they're delighted that he does, giving them what they want. And here it says, who being past feeling, have given themselves over unto lasciviousness. Some people get confused. They say, well, it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and then another portion says he hardened his heart. Well, that's exactly what happens. When God hardens a man's heart, he is going to harden his heart. The only reason any of us have been brought to Christ is because God in grace and mercy has drawn us willingly against our will. He's caused us to see in Christ our need, stripped us of every self-confidence for his, showed us our lost estate. And I don't know about you, but I'd never want to go back to that blindness. I'd never want to go back to that ignorance. My eyes are, by God's grace, on Christ. And that's where the Lord draws each of us. But left to oneself, a person will never turn to God, never turn to Christ. They'll turn to many other things. for comfort, for hope, but not to Christ. So if the Lord has turned your heart, thank Him, because that's a grace, that's a mercy.